We haven't done the studies on everything. I'm just writing a paper at the moment about reflexology. As I said, I tried it. We haven't got any studies on whether reflexology is going to help you naturally or with fertility treatment. But the claims that are made by some clinics and some practitioners are really bold, that this is going to improve your chance of having a baby. So that's the message I really want to get across, what the evidence is. And if there are no evidence, then you've got to be careful of people that are claiming.
That's our guest, Joyce Harper, talking about her book, the constant research that she's doing to help us understand more about fertility education, the gaps that there are, the things that we're reliant on, and the things that we should, of course, be wary of. For over 6 years now, the Fertility Podcast has been sharing content with you, talking about the A to Z of things that might be affecting your fertility. And as we head into our seventh year, things are changing. You see, the podcast is just a portal into a world of more support, which ultimately is what you need more than ever when you're trying to conceive. So who are we? Well, I'm Natalie Silverman. If you've listened to the podcast, you'll know. I used to be on the radio. I'm also a professional voiceover, so I basically talk a lot for a living. And I launched this podcast after successful fertility treatment. And in 2019, I brought in the brilliant Kate Davis. Kate is a fertility nurse consultant. You know what you're talking about, and you offer amazing clinical support.
I think it's great to give information out to people this way because it's so accessible. We know from talking to our guests that actually they love listening to it in this way because certainly with men, they can listen to it and no one else knows that they're listening to information about fertility.
Now, part of what is changing with the podcast is that Kate and I are offering an amazing support network. And so what we want to do is offer you the chance to be a patron of this podcast.
So what does all of this mean? You're going to get shout outs on the podcast and your name, if you want it, or it can be your social media handle, will be on the Fertility Podcast website. We're going to be having some awesome monthly get-togethers and we're going to take the time to answer your questions and bring in some fab speakers. And if there's someone you've been really wanting to hear from, you can have a say on who we interview going forward, as we'll be running polls for you to vote on. You'll get early access to our episodes a week ahead of their release. Plus, there's going to be other really useful resources too.
So what you need to do is get on the case and join us today. It's very simple. Just go to patreon.com/thefertilitypodcast. The early years from the Fertility Podcast, where we aim to talk about the stuff you wish you had known before trying to conceive. Now, as you know, the Fertility Podcast is all about empowering you in the next steps in your fertility journey. And we're always delighted to find people who are on the same mission as we are. So we give a massive welcome to Merck, a new sponsor of the Fertility Podcast. They are a leading science and technology company with a rich history in the area of fertility. And with this experience, Merck has launched Bloom, a brand new website intending to provide you with information whether you're looking to start your family or grow it and you need some help on what you're going to do next. So to find out more, just visit merckbloom.com. So we're now going to welcome Professor Joyce Harper to the podcast. Now, Joyce is a Professor of Reproductive Science at the Institute for Women's Health at the University College of London and the Director of the Centre for Human Reproduction. And she's got a really impressive intro that I'm not going to give its full amount to because I'm going to put it in the show notes. But what you do need to know about Joyce is that for over 30 years, she has done a huge amount of research into fertility, genetics, reproductive health and women's health. And she's massively passionate about it. And if you're not following her on Instagram, you should, and we'll give you her details. First of all, welcome Joyce to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Have we spoken on the podcast before? Or have we just spoken on stage? Because we've done a few stages at the fertility show.
Yes, we did a podcast a few years ago now where I told you a lot about my fertility journey and about why I wanted to work now in fertility education.
Thought we had. Well, we'll put that link in the show notes.
I saw, Joyce, that your twins were 15, was
it?
Yes. Oh, lovely. Hope they had a lovely birthday.
Frozen embryo transfer.
Make sure you listen to Joyce's story from how she became a mum to twins. We'll put that link in the show notes. Joyce, it's lovely to have you here. And like I say, we've spoken at the fertility show on stages before. Last time you were actually launching your fertility education poster, weren't you?
Yes, I was.
Let's just talk about the crux of the mission that you're on when it comes to fertility education.
Actually, back in 1987, when I started working as an embryologist, I really was aware that my friends didn't understand how their body worked, how their fertility worked, how contraception worked. And I started writing a book back then to help my friends understand how everything worked, a book for the public. And I don't know where 30 years went, but they did disappear somewhere. I've been very aware over the last 30 years that we still don't teach people this information, men and women, about their fertile years. So about 4 years ago, I thought that, you know, I need to sit down and write this book. So that's what I've been doing. And I'm really pleased that it'll be coming out, published by Hodder at the beginning of next year. And in the book, I'm covering from really from the beginning of how women are made and eggs and sperm, but really concentrating from puberty to the menopause. A little bit about what happens for men as well. Obviously, it takes two to make a baby, but I'm really passionate that we need to educate people about these fertile years so they know what to do to look after their health of their fertility, but also their pregnancy and beyond. So it's really important we know now about preconception health before we have children, to look that it carries on to the health of our future children. So all of these things I think are so important. If we're not taught them in school, we need to be taught them somewhere. So I'm really on a mission now in the next 10 years or so to get out there, get this information to people from school children to everybody.
This is so up your street, Kate.
It's so up my street and absolutely fascinating. And you know, get, like you say, it's your mission to get out there for the next 10 years and get that information to as many people as possible. And certainly, definitely starting in schools is where we need to be, because, you know, we talk about so much, don't we, when we're trying not to conceive, what to do not to conceive when we're in school, and not anything about our fertility education. And that's so important.
I think the message we give in schools is quite negative. They obviously tell you about how to have sex, and they tell you how not to get pregnant and how not to get an STI, but they don't tell you how to have sex to have children and how to have healthy children and healthy sex. So that's something that I really want to look at. And I've done quite a bit of work with teenagers at the moment. I've got three teenagers myself, but I've done work in various schools and things with teenagers. And if you ask them how many times you have to have intercourse to have sex, to have a baby, sorry, and when's the best time, they don't actually know. So how are people supposed to know when they're trying to have children? How are they supposed to know when the fertile window is? How are they supposed to know how many times they're supposed to have sex to give themselves the optimum chance? And we're seeing women delay having children longer and longer, as men are as well. But so many people now don't even start thinking about children until they're in their 30s. And I'm sure people listening to this podcast will know that female fertility does decline from our early 30s onwards, depending, obviously, it's individual. But especially around the age of 35, it becomes really significant. If we're not even trying to have children till we're in our 30s, we're making that window very, very small. And I don't want to see people in the fertility clinic. I want them to know what they need to do to have children naturally and to make sure they do it in the right way. I don't want people to go through what I went through.
No, I completely agree. And one thing that, you know, going back to schools that frustrates me, and we talk about how not to get pregnant, and even just that awareness of when you are more fertile, that information is so important. And young people could use that information to have a little bit more knowledge about when they need to be really thinking and really super careful, and especially if they need to get emergency contraception. You know, just having that awareness would make such a difference. Talking about kind of awareness and how we're kind of changing the information that we want and the information that we use. And this is kind of in relation to fertility apps and the rise of fertility apps. I think I'm right in saying that you're about to publish a paper that's analysed quite a large number of fertility apps. Can you tell us a little more, bit more about that and what you were looking for and interestingly, what you found out?
Yeah, I think apps are great. I mean, I'm sure we all use apps. I use apps every day. We do. And I think we need to use them in a really good way. And I think what they information they give us, especially about our health, where they're very popular for health, I think it needs to be accurate. So we're doing a study at the moment, we just finished, that we're going to publish soon, on menstrual cycle apps. But we have published, it's out now, but in pre-proofs, a study on looking at the fertility apps. And fertility apps could be a wonderful way to educate people about their fertile window and how to increase their chances of having a child. But unfortunately, the data that we looked at, we looked in detail at over 90 apps, and the majority of the apps only looked at the menstrual cycle dates. Mm-hmm. And the menstrual cycle dates give us very limited information. Women are not the textbook 28 days ovulating on day 14. And that's what they might have learned at school. I know my sons have learned this at school. But this is really a textbook, and we're not textbooks, we're all individual. A study that I did last year, we looked at over 600,000 cycle menstrual cycles for people using an app. And we found that a very small number of women have a 28-day cycle, the textbook 28 days, and very few ovulate on day 14. Mm. The majority, well, the average was actually day 17 for ovulation. And anything between 21 days and 35 days for your menstrual cycle length is actually considered normal. So if that's the case, and the app you're looking at, your fertility app, is just telling you, oh, you're going to ovulate on day 14, you could miss it totally. It could either be sooner or later. We had some women ovulating on day 10. So I think fertility apps will be great as long as they give accurate information. And one of my bugbears at the moment is that we shouldn't be using any app, menstrual cycle or fertility app, that's looking at dates and tell women when they ovulate. Mm. So what we need to do is look at one of the markers of ovulation. So we need to have intercourse around the time of ovulation, and our fertile window is actually 5 days before the day of ovulation, because sperm can last in the female reproductive tract for up to 5 days. And on the day of ovulation, the egg only lasts for 24 hours. So then the fertile window is closed. So that's our fertile window. So we can use a number of markers to look for that, to help women understand when they're ovulating. But dates are out. We shouldn't be looking at dates.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And it's my utter pet hate, this day 28-day cycle and day 14 ovulation. And I think as health professionals as well, we need to get away from saying that, because sometimes we're still saying that and it's so incorrect.
Absolutely. So there are some markers that we can use to see when a woman's ovulating. We can look at her basal body temperature. It slightly changes just around the time of ovulation. We can look at her cervical mucus. It's a little bit more messy, but you can look at how your mucus changes. You can use an ovulation stick, which you just urinate on, and it looks for the surge of a hormone called luteinizing hormone. And I just heard last week, which I hadn't heard before, companies just launched a new app where you measure your carbon dioxide. So you breathe into this gadget every day. And I look back, there are some very early papers from about 10 years ago that suggesting that our carbon dioxide will change through our menstrual cycle.
Wow, that's interesting.
I never heard of that.
No, neither have I.
Quickly added it to my book. It's quite new, and it really needs to be validated. And obviously without apps and gadgets that could do that, you know, 10 years ago, you couldn't have measured your CO2. But yeah, it's interesting. So with all of these, we need validation. And the first three methods I mentioned, they're really established now. So it'd be interesting to see this carbon dioxide for checking our fertility. So I think when women can understand and use those methods to find out when they're, as an individual, are ovulating, that's the important thing we need to get through to women and men.
We will investigate. Now, Joyce, I know you've been using the Insta community for some of your book research, because I saw you asking a question the other day about whether people think that women who live and work together have got synchronized menstrual cycles. I want to talk to you about that in a sec, but I also just want, we've just talked about the downside of apps, and I want to just gauge from you in writing this book and wanting to have this, you know, credible information for people, how you feel about the growth of this TTC community, especially somewhere like Instagram, because it's powerful, it's amazing, it's supportive, but there's a lot of patient experts there. So just tell me a bit about how it's been in terms of useful for you, but also I'm interested in any concerns that you might have.
So social media is a good one, isn't it? So I have used it to see what the community are talking about. I've put questions out there which have really helped me. You know, I think it's important to listen to other people who, especially people that have been through fertility journeys, to see what sort of things are on their mind. Where my book is sitting is that I have tried to demystify the scientific information. So there is so much out there with any social media. We always talk about false news, and there's so much out there. It's you know, people are bombarded with all this information. How do you know what's really true or not? So when I look into a lot of these things, I've read so many papers. I've never read so many scientific papers in my life. But the fertility supplement, you know, should we be eating pineapple? You know, the list is endless. You know, exercise, but not too much exercise. All of these things. What I've done is, obviously, I've been working on many of these areas for the last 30 years, but I've read everything about all of these topics to try and help couples going through fertility treatment understand what's right or wrong. Because I've been there. I've been that vulnerable patient who I tried acupuncture, I tried reflexology, I looked at my nutrition. Obviously, there are some supplements that are important for the baby, such as folic acid. So, you know, I know what it's like to try all these things. And I think in 2020, we have got such a huge amount of, you know, different suggestions that are going to help your fertility. I think it's a minefield. I didn't have all the answers. And I know that no matter what I say, some people are going to think, oh, but that, you know, that paper, they said, you know, that journalist article, they said that this is going to help. So I'm going to try it. But I've tried to give people the real lowdown on what evidence we actually have to make it more black and white. But it hasn't been easy at all, because some things, we just don't have the studies. We haven't done the studies on everything. I'm just writing a paper at the moment about reflexology. You know, as I said, I tried it. We haven't got any studies on whether reflexology is going to help you naturally or with fertility treatment. So what can we say? But the claims that are made by some clinics and some practitioners are really bold, that this is going to improve your chance of having a baby. So that's the message I really want to get across, what the evidence is. And if there are no evidence, then you've got to be careful at people that are claiming that this is going to improve your chance of getting pregnant.
On that note then, Joyce, what do you feel about influencers and online patient experts that are in the trying to conceive community? Do you think they're good, that they're raising awareness, or do you have concerns over the information that they're sending out?
Obviously, I'm following a lot, and I think it's great to give people support. I think it's wonderful to get these topics out there on the table and discuss them. I think it's difficult if they're claiming that something's going to help. I do yoga, for example. There's been a lot on fertility yoga and really bold claims about what fertility yoga will do. I don't quite agree with some of those really, really bold claims. I mean, we were at the fertility show last year. There was the royal jelly. There was the fertility astrologers. Yeah, the fertility astrologers. The websites look amazing.
I didn't see the fertility astrologers.
Yeah, I saw them.
Yeah, I've been checking their websites recently. There's one that's called fertility. I think it's just called fertilityastrologers.co.uk. And they said they just need your date of birth, the town you were born in, and they're going to work out when you're fertile.
I know.
I mean, I'm sorry, I'm a scientist. That just doesn't make any sense.
I know.
How can that work? You might have blocked fallopian tubes. You might, well, I think they'll know obviously from your date of birth, time of birth, and your location.
Yeah.
And I know people really love astrology, and it's a really useful thing for some people and supportive. But we've got to understand that as a scientist, that's not logical. That just doesn't make any sense to me.
It's the worry, isn't it, that these women are vulnerable women and they will try anything, and so will be sucked in by this.
And it's these things are expensive. They really, really add up. So, you know, if you start doing all of these things, I know many people who, when they went through fertility treatment, only afforded one cycle. They had enough money for two or three, but the clinic added on so many add-ons that it sucked all the money, and it's all gone in one cycle. And so, as I said, I've been there, and my aim is really just trying to help people sift through, you know, all this mumbo jumbo and what's really evidence-based. That's the phrase that we use. What is evidence-based medicine? And unfortunately, lots of these things aren't. Some of them won't harm people, but they will harm your wallet. And that's a big concern.
Well, you've almost made this seamless for me, because we were talking about astrologers and then you moved smoothly into add-ons, which was going to be my next question, because you also had been sharing on your Insta that you've been looking at the way fertility clinics advertise their three main add-ons. What were the key findings? I mean, we know add-ons is so contentious. Both Kate and I talk to people all the time about how they feel about it. And I've got constant conversations of people advising one another in my closed Facebook community, which always worries me. What were the key findings from what you did?
So we did an audit last year of the IVF clinic website. So I did do a really much more detailed one a few years ago, but we never actually published it. So we updated it and we looked at assisted hatching, time-lapse imaging, and pre-implantation genetic testing for aneuploidy. So two of those have got red ratings from the HFEA, and I'm involved with the HFEA. I'm an advisor to the committee that has set up the traffic light system on the HFEA website. And so PGTA and assisted hatching have a red rating from the HFEA, and time-lapse imaging has an amber. So the red rating means that there's no evidence that this is going to improve your chance of a live birth. Now, we know that there are some other things people might want to look into, and I'm working with the HFEA to try and make the information we give patients more detailed, but we've had to try and juggle the detail and the simplicity so that people can easily understand what we're trying to say. So we have just looked at the birth rate. With PGTA, there's been 30 years of research on PGTA showing all of the trials, almost all the trials showing that it didn't actually make any difference to improving live birth rate. But what our study found is that a lot of the clinics in the UK are charging about £3,000 for, in my view and in the HFEA's view, an unproven treatment. So I think this is a real issue. I'm still hearing of patients now who are obviously being told, well, this will improve your chance of live birth rates. We looked at the claims on IVF clinic websites. What are they saying this treatment will do? And indeed, some of them do say that all three of those treatments I mentioned will improve their chance of live birth. But there's no clear evidence that that is actually true. As I said, many, many years of research on these, not just, I mentioned reflexology earlier, there's not actually been any studies. So that has to be rated red because there are no studies. For all of the treatments I mentioned, assisted hatching, time-lapse and PGTA, there are numerous studies and we're not seeing...
So patients are ignoring the traffic light system and they're listening to the clinics ultimately?
The clinics are telling them that they should ignore them. And I know one clinic last week had told the patients, given the patients the link to one of the papers of one of the big randomized controls trials that came out last year, which clearly says in the conclusion that there's no significant improvement in live birth rate from this very large multi-center international study. And the one that Eshra, our big fertility organization, ran and published last year also shows the same thing. So two large studies. And I don't understand why that's getting ignored. But I must say, I have had a lot of issues over the years with some of my colleagues who have been very angry at me for making these comments and saying that this technology doesn't work. But I need to stand by my principles. I was asked to do a debate a few weeks ago on PGTA, and I've said no now. I did two at the end of last year and found it incredibly stressful. I was really upset with the way that my colleagues had dealt with the debate and felt that it was not done in a sensitive way. And I just got too nasty, to be honest. So I've now decided to try and step back from that. But I have written the book, and in the book I have said my view. So I'm still going to upset some people who want to offer the treatment.
But it's fascinating. It's fascinating to hear that you, as somebody with the experience and the background that you have within the industry, are having these conversations with your peers. Mm-hmm. And think of what the patient, you know, how overwhelmed the patient's like. If people with the knowledge and experience, understanding of yourselves and your contemporaries are disagreeing, patients are just totally floundered when it comes to knowing what's right for them when they're so desperate.
And not only that, I find that majority of my patients, when I mention to them about the HFEA website, they don't even know the HFEA website exists. So therefore, they've never even come across the traffic light page, where I think it's now giving quite a lot of good, really good information. So there's something there too that needs to be highlighted more.
The clinics are supposed to tell the patients about the HFEA website, traffic light website. It should be in the patient literature. It should be there.
But I suppose if they're coming to someone like Kate before they've even gone
to
look
at it. Well, even when I see them at all different stages, so they may well be going through IVF, and they will, I'd say probably 8 out of 10 won't know. I sound like 8 out of 10 cats. 8 out of 10 fertility patients won't know about the HFEA website.
That's amazing. Mm. That's amazing. I will.
It's worrying.
I will feed that back. We have always said that this has been the problem, but I had hoped that it had really improved. I mean, I've tried to mention it a lot. I need to mention it more. It's obviously features in the book. So, and I'm hoping the HFEA are going to add the complementary therapies on as well. In the HFEA patient survey they did, the second most requested add-on had been acupuncture. And so we've done a lot of work over that on the last year. We've got 2 papers that we're publishing around acupuncture. There's been a lot of studies on it, and they're very split. And I agree, it's difficult to do a study on acupuncture because of placebo and sham acupuncture. It's complicated, but it's mixed evidence. And in my view, it would be an amber rating from the HFEA. But as I said, reflexology, that's nothing. So that would have to be read. So but we've got to get that information out to patients for sure. So I will feed that back to the HFEA because it should absolutely be in all the clinics, patient information.
Yeah. I mean, in general, I think fertility conversations, we are talking more. Patients are talking more. There is more information out there. And I know last November, BBC Radio 2 did a fantastic job of highlighting fertility. And then I know recently, Joyce, you've been involved with Magic Radio when they had a week-long fertility project that was going, which was fantastic. I did listen to a little bit of it. What was that experience like for you, and what feedback have you had about it?
It's really great. But what I find is women telling me all the time, I didn't know that. I just asked 12 women I didn't know to read the 12 chapters of my book and give me some feedback. One of the questions I said to them was, have you learned something? And they all said, oh my goodness, I didn't know that. I didn't know, you know, that literally one of them's written on it, sort of every paragraph. I didn't know that. And it, so this just amazes me that there are so many people out there who still don't know some of the real basics of our fertile years. So in a way, it makes me depressed because I think, oh my, we have got so much work to do. So I co-set up the UK Fertility Education Initiative with Adam Balin and Jackie Bovin. And then the fertility poster I did last year was, it came from a conference we'd had on preconception health in Copenhagen last September. And there were some brilliant key players there. And we got together and then I just woke up one morning and said, let's do a poster. And I contacted a few of them. But we had a meeting in July, and we've now set up as an international fertility education initiative and trying to bring together, we've got a group of really multidisciplinary team of psychologists, health economics people, clinicians, embryologists, scientists, you know, all sorts of people, bringing together the information that and research that we need to do to get fertility awareness out there. And we all realize what a huge job we've got to do. So there are some countries that are a little bit ahead of the game, such as the UK and Denmark, for example, but there's some that haven't even started. So I'm doing some work with Greece. We've just set up a Greek fertility education initiative. They don't even teach sex education in Greece. So we're starting from such a difficult place. I mean, and the UK, we campaigned during a consultation document that the Department of Health put out a few years ago to get fertility and reproductive health on the UK curriculum. And we're so pleased now it is there. So before that, the word fertility didn't even feature in any document from the Department of Education. So now it's there. So now we can start getting this information into schools. And I'm doing a project now where I want to go into schools, a variety of schools, and ask children what they know already, but also what are their views about their future family? Do they want to have children? Do they not want to have children? Do they know how same-sex couples can have children? How trans men and women can have children? So all of these things, I really want to make sure people are fully aware of this information so everyone can make an informed choice. But we're starting from almost a negative situation. So there's a huge amount of work to do, huge.
Yeah. But also things like the Magic Radio project and the Radio 2 one, which were both brilliant, but they're predominantly talking to women who are already thinking, and men who are already thinking about this. They're already maybe trying and struggling or maybe going through it. And so what I'd be really excited to hear more about is when these conversations start to happen more on your Radio One, and we're doing more stuff. And I know it's stuff that you've thought about, Joyce, on YouTube and TikTok and the places that these younger conversations are happening, because we can do all the study and we can all talk about it as people that are in it and know it's something that we're so amazed when others don't know about it. But it's those channels, isn't it? It's the channels to get that message through.
That's why I'm doing more on Instagram. I've done a lot on Twitter for quite a few years. So now I've realized I've got to get out there to the younger generations. I am ready to get out there, do whatever we need to do. I mean, I really would love to do a documentary, a TV documentary. We can get out on Netflix or whatever. There's Sex Education, the drama, such a great program. I learned something on that I didn't know about. I was like, wow, that's amazing. And, I think that's great. That's teaching. I said to my boys, you know, have they taught you that about that at school? And they're, no, they're not going to say that. So I think media is a great way to communicate to people. And I'm going back to the apps. I think the apps could be a really great way to feed women. So if I'd love to work more with a menstrual cycle app, so, or all of them, you know, they could be telling women, if a woman has an irregular cycle, are they telling them, we notice you're having an irregular cycle?
I think some do.
You know, this might affect your fertility. I think some do. You're right. But we could also be feeding them little snippets of fertility education. Yeah, you know, I've used the Noom app before for, you know, the nutrition app. And, you know, every day you learn a bit of science. You know, today we're going to learn a bit of psychology about, you know, this and that and the other. And I think this would be a great way to feed information to teenagers and young adults to start getting them aware. Because even if we start teaching in schools now, what about those people who are 19 or 20 or 25 or 30? We've got this backlog of people. And as I said, this is just the UK. What about other countries? So Greece, I mentioned earlier, Greece has one of the highest ages of women having their first child. It's higher than the UK. I think last time I looked, it was about 31. And what we're seeing is that couples are not, or people are not having their desired family size either. We're seeing many more people having one child. So something that we look at globally is the total fertility rate, which is the number of children a woman has on average through the whole country. And when I was a child, that used to be 2.4. So we used to talk about a family being 2.4 children. And now in some European countries, it's 1.3. So what's happened to our family size? And some of these are really countries that, you know, their culture is to have a big family, very family orientated cultures. And they're having really small numbers of children. And I'm sure that's not plan A for these people to have that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's that lack of education.
Well, we need you on TikTok then, Joyce. That's what we need.
I haven't hit TikTok yet.
Not yet. So do you think, though, in the time that you've been on more of a crusade, and you've mentioned the fertility initiative, and obviously, you know, I know how involved you were with Fertility Fest, and we all know what an amazing job Jessica and the arts were doing to get that message to a younger audience. And there definitely has been a shift. Do you think that it is changing when you're going into schools, that more notice is being taken? Obviously, you've got it on the curriculum, but do you feel that it's happening rather than it needs to happen?
I think we're probably in a little bubble. I'm in a bubble with my three sons, who we talk about everything that most parents would blush at what we chat about during dinner. And obviously the Fertility Fest, we're seeing this amazing work going on, and all the work we've done with young people and Jessica, it's just amazing. But I think we are in a bubble. So at Fertility Fest last year, I'd seen all these amazing women who had not had children, and they gave amazing talks, and it was just so stimulating. And so that made me say, well, I want to do a study on childlessness and look at women who are past the normal reproductive age, so over 46, and see how they feel if they had wanted children, how they felt about being childless. And this study's in press at the moment, but it's not out yet. So I'm hoping it'll be out soon. And we have done the men this year. And I had thought, because I'd been surrounded by people, many people like Jessica, that women and men were going to feel positive about their, not positive, but had dealt with their childlessness and had moved on. and were living very full lives. And actually, our survey doesn't show that. So I think sometimes we get in our little bubble of, yes, everyone around me is talking about fertility, and we've got the fertility poster and, you know, people with their kids and everything. But I think when we get to grassroots level, I'm not convinced that that's really getting out. So I do some work with Hammersmith and Fulham, and there was a really dynamic young girl who is at a very strict Catholic school in Fulham. And she said they've not learned any sex education. Everything I told her about, she said, wait, we have not touched any of that. So listening to her made me realize that one thing I want to do is go into her school and then go into one of the very progressive schools that's just down the road and compare our survey of teenagers and what they understand. And one of the face-to-face things I did was with a group of teenagers, again, in Hammersmith and Fulham. We were at Chelsea Football Club last summer. And this was when I'd asked them, when is a woman, what day is of a cycle is a woman most fertile? How many times do you have to have sex to have to get pregnant? They didn't know. Some of them didn't know what puberty meant. And the person I was organising it with used to be head of sex education. And we were just devastated by what they were telling us. Absolutely devastated. So I'm not convinced that it's out there at all, even in the UK.
Well, one of the things that we've been saying with this series of the podcast, the early years, especially when we're kind of sharing it on social, is that we need the people that are listening to this to share it to the people that they think might need to listen to it. Because the only way we can get this ripple effect is by the people that are already in this bubble, and bubble being the most operative, most poignant word, considering what's going on in the world. But we are in our fertility bubble, and we need our community to reach out to their communities, because everybody, whether they have their own children or not, will know children or know people who have children that are at the age that could benefit from this. And so that's definitely part of what the mission is that Kate and I are on with especially this series of the podcast, is to is to really get people to think about sharing it more and more. And I know that's what you were trying to do with your poster, weren't you?
Yeah, and I'm really, really happy to go out to any school and talk to the teachers, talk to the kids, whatever. And the Department of Education have asked the Fertility Education Initiative to help with the tools that we will give to teachers to help teach them. And it's not rocket science. It's nothing complicated that we need to say. So, and with the survey that we're doing in schools, I just want to start getting out there. Obviously, I was just about to go into a couple of schools and then lockdown happened. So I'm trying to work with our local school to just pilot the survey for children and then get out there. And the next year, I just want to go to as many schools as I can, you know, just get a whole year group ideally to do the survey and just find out what young people are thinking, what they know. I haven't given them a multiple choice, but I have said, have you learnt about any of these in school? So something like miscarriage, in the event we did in Chelsea Football Club, very few of them really understood what a miscarriage was. You know, we still got these taboos. We need to get these things on the table and talk about them. You know, I've heard about someone very recently who's just had a scan and the baby's not alive anymore. And this person hasn't told any of her family. I mean, again, these things that we do to make our life really difficult. Why is it taboo? Why aren't our family and friends supporting us if we go through a miscarriage or if we go through infertility? We should really have these conversations out on the table and get them discussing. And the menopause, you know, we should discuss the menopause at school. School children know some woman, a teacher or their mother or their auntie or someone going through the menopause. They should understand why we keep sweating all the time or whatever. You know, these things should be out on the table. So this is really what I'm doing for the next 10 years.
Well, it's exciting, and we're delighted that the book has been put down, has been penned, and we await its release. And Joyce, thank you as always for sharing. And together we will continue on our mission to spread the word and get the conversations happening, because as you say, it's very important. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We really hope you enjoyed the show. All the info of our guests will be below this episode in whichever podcast app you are listening in. And remember, if you do one new thing today to help you get even more support on your fertility journey, why not become a patron of this podcast? Just visit patreon.com/thefertilitypodcast.